Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
We would all have an interest in trying to avoid escalation to all-out nuclear war, which would, in fact, mean the end of at least civilization as we know it.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Battle Lines.
Regardless of who stands with Israel, Israel will fight until this battle is won.
两岸同胞要携手同心, 共享民族复兴的
I made wartime decisions. I know the choices are never clear or easy for the leadership.
I just find bombs and I find dead people, but it's a really scary thing for me.
On today's bonus episode of Battle Lines, Berlin correspondent James Rothwell speaks to Professor James Davis, a former advisor to Angela Merkel's government and the head of a new research group, which has been launched to advise experts and European leaders on the current nuclear crisis between Russia and NATO. They discuss what the West's reaction would be to a nuclear attack by Russia and what precedent that would set for countries like India, Pakistan, and North Korea. Here's their conversation.
James, first of all, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me, James.
I'd like to start with the question of risk and fear in light of the fact that there seems to be a lot of concern in Europe and beyond at the moment about the risk of a nuclear escalation and the possible use of Russian nuclear weapons by Vladimir Putin in Ukraine, or even perhaps potentially on a NATO state. And I'm curious for your thoughts on how dangerous the situation has become in your view.
Well, that's a question we're all asking ourselves. I think where you come down on this at the end of the day reflects some assumptions that you're making about where the risks reside. I think if we think of decision makers as rational, security-maximizing leaders of their countries, the risks remain relatively low. There, at least so far, seem to be no threats to Russia's existence as a state that would warrant any decision to use nuclear weapons, realizing that one does not know what the response to that would be, whether we're talking about the response of world public opinion, which I think would be dramatically anti-Russian in a way that it perhaps is not yet, or whether we're thinking of the military responses that could result from breaking what the Brown University political scientist Nina Tannenwald calls the nuclear taboo. If that were breached, I think there would be political pressures on states to punish Russia in one way or the other. So if you're thinking about the threat of use of a nuclear weapon through the lenses of rational decision making, you can probably remain relatively sanguine at this point. If, however, you think that things oftentimes happen even though nobody wanted them to, that is to say that wars can escalate in ways that are unanticipated, that things can get out of control because the systems in which we are operating are very complex, and one action leads not only to one reaction, but there are multiple effects of anything we do, many of which are unanticipated, or you can't even foresee them, then of course you worry that we could have some kind of an escalation scenario, even though no rational actor in the chain of command wanted it. And that's, I think, where it gets both interesting intellectually to think about this, but also very important from a standpoint of policy, because obviously we would want to reduce such risks to the extent that we can identify them as much as we possibly can.
Based on what Vladimir Putin has said about the use of nuclear weapons over the course of this war. And there's obviously a difference between what a person may say about nuclear weapons and what they actually think. Do you have a sense that he might be using a sort of madman theory here, trying to terrify the West, or is there perhaps something else going on?
I think a few things are worth noting. Over the course of the last decade or so, that Russia has envisaged for nuclear weapons in its planning, military planning, the role that nuclear weapons play in Russian doctrine has actually been reduced. And most scholars who've looked at this and military analysts have looked at this attribute that to the fact that over the course of the last 10 or 15 years, Russia was able to reconstitute its conventional forces. And as it was able to reconstitute its conventional capabilities, the resort to nuclear, rapid or early resort to nuclear weapons in a crisis or in a war scenario, that has been diminished. And so from that standpoint, I tend to think of the nuclear saber rattling as an attention-getting maneuver, not so much a real indication of intent or impending intent to use nuclear weapons. The doctrinal development over the last 10 years in Russia has more or less reserved the use of nuclear weapons for cases where there is an existential threat to the Russian state. Now, that is not well defined. We don't know what that means, nor do we know what that means, or that means in general, nor do we know what that means for Vladimir Putin. Is an existential threat to the Russian state only apparent when it looks like Moscow is going to be attacked with nuclear weapons? Or would the loss of, for example, Crimea, now that it has been annexed by Russia and by all accounts is believed by Putin to be an integral part of the Russian state, if one were able to credibly threaten the recapture of Crimea, would that trigger that notion of an existential threat? I think that's what we don't know. And I think what's, you know, probably interesting is Putin himself probably doesn't know. Most of the time we try to model escalation dynamics in warfare under the assumption that leaders are clearly aware of what their goals are, what their preferences are. I tend to think that we oftentimes don't know our own goals or preferences. These emerge in the context of strategic interaction. And that makes any kind of prediction very difficult.
All these jitters about the possible use of nuclear weapons by Putin has revived a debate that I believe Macron started in 2020 about an EU nuclear deterrent, perhaps one that can compensate for a lack of engagement from the United States if Donald Trump were to win the next election. Are you able to tell us what an EU nuclear deterrent would look like and whether it's a feasible ambition to have?
I think the first thing to notice there are at least two independent European nuclear deterrent forces, right? So you have the United Kingdom's independent nuclear forces and the Fostefrapp in France, the French nuclear deterrent. And both of these actors have always suggested that these are independent but complementary contributions to the larger project of deterring an attack, in particular deterring a nuclear attack on Western Europe. So we have, you know, a history of independent European nuclear forces. The question is, how can one turn these national deterrent forces into something like an EU force? And that raises, I think, primarily political questions, but also some technical questions. But the political questions are, of course, what would constitute an attack or a I was going to say threat, but let's say what would constitute an attack on Europe that would warrant a retaliatory strike? That's a question of doctrine, and I have not seen any discussion yet at the European level on what that type of a doctrine would look like. And before you can begin to talk about then the requirements for implementing a retaliatory strike, which is necessary for making the threat to implement such a strike credible, you need to sort of think through what the trigger would be. And so I think what we need to do is we need to see when President Macron says such things, what does he have in mind? Is this the opening up of the French force to multilateral decision-making body? Or is this just, we French are willing to step in to compensate for a lack of credibility of the United States' extended nuclear deterrence, should that ever come about? I don't think it's very smart to call into question the credibility of the United States' extended nuclear deterrent. They've been successfully pursuing that strategy for at least 70 some odd years. Until you have something else in place, it seems to me rather irresponsible to call it into question, the credibility of into question. But these are precisely the sorts of questions that I think our study group is going to be focused on.
If deterrence didn't work and the decision was made by Putin to launch a nuclear strike on Ukraine, would that open a sort of Pandora's box in which other countries also tempted to resolve conflicts through nuclear weapons might follow suit?
Yeah, I think what's necessary here is to really put some serious thinking into the day after such an eventuality. During the Cold War, when we were thinking about nuclear deterrence, usually in the context of protecting allies, it was thought to be necessary to make the other side, to assure the other side that a response would be swift and overwhelming. That was what was considered to be necessary to deter any use of a nuclear device. If a swift and overwhelming response came as a result of that, then there could be no rational reason to engage in a nuclear strike. What we're dealing with here in the Ukraine is a somewhat different situation. The Ukraine is not formally allied with NATO, with any nuclear power. The question is, if a nuclear weapon were used on a non-nuclear state that's not part of any formal alliance, what's the smart response? And I don't think anybody has thought too deeply about that. I think there may be very good reasons why one would not want to do anything for a day or two. Perhaps the collective weight of world opinion would be so massive that a response in kind would not necessarily be the wisest way to go. But I think we need to think that through. But I think if, in fact, Putin were to use a tactical nuclear device in the Ukraine and paid no price for that, paid no heavy price for that, then the conclusion you suggested would be correct, that others might think this is a perfectly legitimate way to proceed. And there are enough countries around the world that have nuclear devices that have conflicts with their neighbors that this would be something we ought to be thinking about.
For example, India and Pakistan, do you mean?
India, Pakistan, obviously the Middle East in one connection or another, North Korea, and then, of course, China, Taiwan, which people worry about as well. So there are enough places where we would want to actually try to avoid that outcome, or that conclusion being reached, that you can break the taboo and not pay a high price for it.
And on the question of deterrence, is there anything that the West is not currently doing that it perhaps should be doing in order to strengthen deterrence against Russia on nuclear affairs?
Well, I mean, the first thing the West might want to pay attention to is just the technical ability to actually respond in the event of a nuclear use. So that's about making sure that command and control communications facilities are robust, hardened, that we know that if someone were to use a nuclear weapon against a state in the West, that we would be able to respond in kind if we so chose, and then be able to communicate that in a credible way. And so we should probably be making sure that all of our systems are operative and robust. I think enough of them are. There are enough redundancies in most of these systems that we don't need to really question the capability necessary to respond in kind. But there have been a few embarrassing moments of late. UK systems that haven't operated as they should upon testing. There are obviously aging nuclear forces, and so questions of modernization are perfectly legitimate to be asked. The question of dual-capable aircraft in Europe, I think, has now been answered. The Germans have decided to buy the F-35, as have a number of other European states, but having dual-capable aircraft makes it possible for the nuclear sharing agreements to be operative, and that's certainly important. One may want to think about, in the context of a changed environment, one may want to think about more forward deployment of nuclear forces. The Intermediate Range Nuclear Force Agreement is no longer operative, and reports suggest the Russians have moved nuclear forces into Belarus, and one may want to think about ways in which one can enhance the credibility of European deterrence. I think the basic lessons have been learned. It's just a matter of updating them to current eventualities. The other part of this is more of a psychological question. And here I think, especially in Germany, you see an effort by some political leaders, in particular the relatively new defense minister, to begin to broach the subject of what are the requirements for deterring attack and, if necessary, defending the West against an attack. And he's doing this not merely to identify what capabilities, material capabilities, what weapon systems are necessary, but to prepare the German people for an era when questions of deterrence, questions of defense are going to be at the top of the agenda again, and sort of educate a broader swath of the population so that they understand the notion that after the Cold War, security would, as a central concern for Europe, would fade away, that notion was misplaced.
And you mentioned testing earlier. Is there a way to be absolutely sure that a nuclear weapon works without actually doing a test launch?
It's hotly debated amongst technical experts, and I'm not a technical expert, so I don't really have a position on this. It is a hotly debated topic. There are those that think without actual physically testing a nuclear device, one does not know. And then there are those that feel confident that simulated tests using computer simulations and the like is sufficient. The physics of this is well known. And you don't have to be a particularly sophisticated economy to produce a workable nuclear device. The North Koreans have shown us that. The more interesting technological challenges are more in the realm of delivery systems and precision and the like. But here you can test without actually exploding a nuclear device. But again, people that are much more knowledgeable about this than I am debate the question.
And finally, James, if nuclear weapons were used by Vladimir Putin against a NATO country, I think for many people, the received wisdom is that would lead to, in effect, World War III, or the collapse of NATO, potentially, if there wasn't a very vigorous response from that Western alliance. Is that the case, or are there other pathways that could open up if that scenario were to happen?
The interesting thing about nuclear strategy is that what you threaten to do in peacetime in pursuit of deterrence may not make much sense if deterrence fails. Threatening a massive response to a single use of a nuclear weapon makes sense from the standpoint of deterrence, and you want to make that as credible as possible, or stress the fact that more the way I think about these issues, the fact that the likelihood that things could get out of control in the chaos that would follow the explosion of a nuclear device is enough of a generator of shared risk that you don't want to start that process. You don't want to go down that path. That said, we would all have an interest in trying to avoid escalation to all-out nuclear war, which would, in fact, have mean the end of at least civilization as we know it. It might not lead to the end of all civilization, but enough of our cities in the West would be probably affected that it would change the nature of life for decades to come. We'd have a real incentive to avoid a massive escalation. We would share that incentive with our adversary, right? Because it could not possibly be in Russia's interest to be the victim of a massive retaliatory strike. So although it's perfectly reasonable and perhaps even essential to threaten massive response in the case of a first use, it might not make much sense to do so if deterrence fails. So we really should be thinking about other mechanisms, other possible outcomes. How can you bring a war that starts to turn nuclear to a rapid end so that it doesn't get out of control? That would have to be the most rational avenue for all policymakers after the first use of a nuclear weapon.
James, thank you very much indeed for discussing this with us. It's a very interesting topic.
Thank you, James.
Hi listeners, David Knowles here. It's been nearly 6 months since the start of the Israel-Gaza war, and for the grim anniversary, we want to look back over the past half a year and answer your questions on the conflict. So, in a special episode of Battle Lines, I'll be joined by our Middle East correspondent Natalia Vasilieva and senior foreign correspondent Sophia Yan. If you would like your questions answered, please send us an email. Of course, we prefer direct questions, not comments, but do let us know where in the world you are listening from. We'll do our best to answer as many as possible. The email address is, all lowercase, battlelines@telegraph.co.uk. That's battlelines, battlelines, @telegraph.co.uk. And of course, you can find the address in the show notes on the podcast apps as well. Thank you very much for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.